Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
But the reality is that there's actually much better, smarter ways to create jobs than just kind of doubling down on industries that are clearly sunset.
That's the voice of Ben West, Executive Director of Tankerfree BC. On this show, we talk all things pipeline and the future of the Canadian economy. Stay tuned. My name is Stuart Richardson, and you're listening to Latin Waves. I'm very privileged to have Ben West on the line. Ben West is one of BC's most known environmental activists, and he currently has a position with Tankerfree BC as executive director. Welcome to the show, Ben.
Thanks for having me.
Now, your group opposes the expansion of the Kinder Morgan pipeline, increasing tanker traffic on our coast. To get things started, can you refresh people what the change would be if this pipeline were to be expanded?
Sure. I mean, actually, I think even calling it an expansion is a bit inaccurate. The reality is that this company, Kinder Morgan, a Houston-based company, wants to build a new pipeline along the existing right-of-way. They bought the pipeline, the Trans Mountain Pipeline, in 2005. It was a pipeline that was built in the 1950s, primarily for domestic oil consumption. That's a 300,000-barrel-a-day pipeline, the existing one, of which 100,000 barrels splits off in Abbotsford and heads down to Cherry Point, Washington. 100,000 barrels goes directly to the airport, and then the remaining 100,000 barrels get split between tankers and the Chevron refinery. So in BC, we consume about 150,000 barrels a day. About 50,000 of that comes from the Chevron refinery, and then about, you know, the other 50,000 barrels makes its way on tankers, largely to Washington State or to California to be refined and brought back here. A little bit is for export. You know, in the time since Kinder Morgan bought the pipeline, we've seen the amount of tankers actually increase as they limited the supply that was going to Chevron. Their new proposed pipeline would be about an 800,000 barrel a day pipeline, and that would increase the number of tankers in the inlet from the, you know, something like 20 to 60 that we see annually, up to over 400 a year, and would, you know, be explicitly for the sake of exporting, you know, diluted bitumen or other bitumen products. So, I mean, instead of being a domestic consumption pipeline, which we currently have, it would be a major export pipeline, and turn Burrard Inlet into a, you know, the one place that a tremendous amount of, you know, this kind of heavy oil, which is quite dangerous if spilled, would be making its way through the inlet. Would also be, of course, going along much of the Fraser River, crossing it twice, once close to the headwaters, going through aquifers, close to schools. You know, there's any number of reasons why, you know, there's reasons to be concerned about it. But long story short, is basically a brand new pipeline that, at least for part of its route, follows the existing right-of-way of a project that they built. Or bought.
Thank you for that, because many people do think of it as just a small expansion, but it is a massive new pipeline. Now, we have a political problem, because if this was Stephen Harper, people would be lighting their hair on fire. There'd be a lot more dissent in the media. But we have a very eloquent new Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, who makes wonderful speeches at the UN about climate change and our Canada's role in the world. And he came to the coast here, and he promised a world-class response investment to tanker spills. So what do you make of the new political climate, and what do you feel, what is a world-class response to a spill?
Well, there's a lot to unpack there. Lovely guy, our Prime Minister, isn't he? I like his hair as much as anybody else. I think there's actually, in a bizarre sort of a way, actually a similarity to Donald Trump. I mean, they couldn't be any further apart on the spectrum of, you know, the kinds of things that they say publicly. But I think both Trump and Trudeau use sound bites, talking points to distract away from, you know, the real policy decisions. And actually on the policy decisions, at least when it comes to energy, there's a lot of similarities. I mean, you know, Trudeau is pushing aggressively to have pipelines approved. You know, to be fair, he did, you know, at least say that they're going to stop the Enbridge Northern Gateway pipeline, which was another really bad idea, very unpopular. You know, did campaign on opposing that, But he also campaigned on replacing the National Energy Board process. He, you know, when asked point blank about it, said that Kinder Morgan would not be approved under the existing National Energy Board process, which was a very highly flawed process. You know, the changes that were made under the Harper government actually took away the ability for those with concerns to even cross-examine industry and all the facts that they were presenting. So, I mean, the lion's share of information that was actually used by the federal government to make this decision under Trudeau actually came directly from industry. You know, there is a process right now to do what they're calling NEB modernization, but that does not necessarily mean that, you know, things are going to improve drastically. I hope they do, but definitely doesn't change the fact that they're pushing ahead with a very unpopular, very dangerous project, you know, without the, you know, the social license that they said they needed. He also repeatedly said that politicians issue permits, but the people give permission, you know, and frankly, even with Trudeau in power, you know, there's still a majority of people when polled in British Columbia who oppose this project. And I'd say about a third of the province who feels very strongly about it. Like, you know, there's now over 20,000 people who've signed a pledge saying that they'll get arrested if necessary. You know, it's worth pointing out that in the provincial election, you know, the NDP has said that they would actually not issue the required permits, regardless of Christy Clark's announcement of approval. So there is the potential for this to be stopped at the provincial level, and it will be a big issue in the upcoming provincial election. In fact, some suggest it'll be the biggest issue in the upcoming election. And yeah, I mean, long story short is that, you know, Trudeau is definitely an effective pipeline salesman. You know, he did spend a fair amount of political capital to bring through a carbon tax. You know, so at some level, you have to believe that there's some part of him that believes that climate change is happening. He just seems to believe that market-based solutions are the way to address it and is really not making the connection to climate change and pipelines. In fact, I think he's really doing a disservice by, you know, really confusing the issue in terms of the, you know, scale of the problem, the rate of transition that's required, really the severity of it, and really our responsibility to be responsible in the midst of, you know, what is the single biggest issue facing humanity today, according to the United Nations. Second part of your question, though, was around world-class cleanup. This is one of those kind of convenient things, because the reality is that there really is no such thing as effective cleanup. So world-class, like if you're doing it as good as anybody is doing it internationally, you know, the best-case scenario is something like 15% of the oil that's spilled is being recovered. That's when looking at conventional crude oil spills. If you're talking about a spill of bitumen, really the one example we have of that happening is in the Kalamazoo River in Michigan, which, you know, costs something like 10 times as much as a conventional oil spill to clean up. And the reality is the authorities there said that they were totally unprepared, because a spill of this kind of product is very different than a spill of conventional crude oil, which frankly is bad enough. I mean, either way, you're talking about cancer-causing carcinogens working their way through ecosystems and affecting human health. But when you're talking about a spill of bitumen, what we saw happen in Kalamazoo is that basically the oil separated from the diluent, the basically the product that's blended in with the bitumen, that, you know, usually bitumen's got a viscosity of peanut butter, you know, so you have to blend in some pretty heavy toxins to basically give it the ability to be pushed through a pipe. And what research has shown, there's a big study done by the National Academy of Science, which unfortunately was not considered by the NEB, you know, that showed that with the turbidity in the water, that basically what happens is this oil separates and then sinks to the bottom in the form of tar balls, which then becomes even harder to clean up, you know, because it's now sitting in sediment at the bottom of a river or ocean. Mm. And, you know, and then that makes its way up through the ecosystem, you know, and bioaccumulates in various species and, you know, can cause damage for many years into the future, not just in the immediate. And at the same time, then the chemicals that are released, you know, make their way into the local air supply, you know, first of all, just smell awful. I mean, people had to abandon their homes around the site of the oil spill because everything smelled like rotten eggs. And in fact, some families came back and said, you know, weeks or months later that they basically just didn't want to take anything from their homes because they couldn't get the smell out of it. But then there's just the impacts on human health again. I mean, you know, being exposed to these toxic chemicals is really dangerous. I mean, even with world-class cleanup, you're not saying much. And frankly, in BC right now, we're not even doing as well as they are in the United States or elsewhere. There's authorities in Washington State who've raised concern about the inadequacy of the spill response in British Columbia. You know, if you look at the Marathassa spill from a couple of summers ago, I mean, that was a small spill, happened right in, you know, daylight in the middle of one of the busiest cities in the region. And, you know, still that oil made its way onto beaches all over Burrard Inlet. So, you know, world-class spill response doesn't mean much. Sounds great. Has more to do with public relations than really guaranteeing that there won't be an impact if there's a spill. Truth is, nobody can promise you there won't be a spill, and nobody can promise that they could actually clean it up effectively.
I live close to this inlet. I see the crystal clear teeming waters. I see million-dollar homes down the road. I see businesses. I see fisheries. I see tourism. What is the estimated cost to this region if there's a spill?
Well, I mean, just for starters, the city of Vancouver actually did a study on the brand value of the city and what the impact of the spill could be on investment in the region. So, I mean, even without going into the direct impacts on people's homes, on, you know, beachfront properties, or the, you know, impact on jobs and tourism or other sectors like fisheries, even just at a brand level, you know, is they're talking about a risk in the millions, if not billions. To this region in terms of investment. Then when you start looking at it in terms of, you know, the potential to impact jobs, I mean, you know, this project would create about 1,000 jobs, maybe 1,500 jobs, depending on how you look at the numbers during the construction phase, you know, like building a large shopping mall or something like that. But, you know, at the end of the day, you're really talking about something in the neighborhood of 50 permanent jobs, most of which would go to, you know, to specialists, well, not even necessarily people from British Columbia. Meanwhile, there's many more jobs that are actually being put at stake. You know, the tourism sector is huge in this region. You know, that investment that drives construction. I mean, construction is actually the number one employer of people in this region. You know, so there is big implications. But I mean, you know, needless to say, there's a reason why even folks who you might think of as being sort of supporters of this kind of industry in West Vancouver, who've got these big properties, you know, I mean, there's strong opposition from the city of West Vancouver, North Vancouver, Vancouver, mm-hmm. Burnaby. I mean, this isn't just environmental activists and First Nations communities who've raised concerns. It's, you know, a wide array of people in this province representing, you know, the whole spectrum of all the different kinds of people who live here.
Now, let's talk a little bit philosophically about the nation. I hear all the time that BC is part of Canada and we don't have any constitutional rights to block oil in a province, to landlock oil and protect it from tidewater. So what about the interest and the so-called national interests of getting that oil to the marketplace for our overall economy?
Well, I mean, frankly, I think, you know, they're really selling false hope to people in Alberta. And I think this is shameful and unfortunate, frankly. I mean, I think there's this idea that oil basically equals money, which, you know, goes back a ways. And, you know, there, of course, have been a lot of really good paying jobs in Alberta as a result of the oil sands. I don't want to pretend that that isn't the case. But the reality is that people have been losing their jobs in Alberta, not because of the lack of pipelines, but because of the price of oil. You know, this has a lot more to do with geopolitics, you know, and the relationship between the U.S. and OPEC, right? Like, I mean, basically, folks in the Middle East were limiting their production to try to artificially keep prices high because of a deal that they had with, you know, the United States and others, which because of, you know, big amount of oil that's being extracted from fracking now in the U.S., as well as offshore, you know, the United States is quietly and without most people becoming aware of it, has actually become the biggest producer of gas in the world, natural gas, because of fracking. And they've also, they're now, I think, number two for oil. So, you know, the folks in OPEC have basically said, well, why should we limit our production? You know, we'll just continue to pump more conventional crude oil onto the market, which has driven the price way down. And the effect has been that, you know, places like Alberta, which has got a very high price for extraction because there's this whole extra step involved, the, you know, the need to separate out the sand and clay from the oil, let alone all the extra effort that's required to even get it out of the ground. You know, so, I mean, it's a very expensive oil product, which only really made sense as the price of oil got above $80, $90, $100 a barrel. You know, most of the estimates I've seen is that to even make money in Alberta, you have to be over $80 a barrel. We're hovering somewhere in that neighborhood, but I mean, oil has dropped down below $50, you know, in recent months. So, you know, this idea that a pipeline is going to change things drastically is just simply inaccurate. Of course, there's jobs to be created in the phase where the pipeline is being built. But, you know, I think that it's really just not telling people the truth if they're being told that building this new pipeline is going to bring back all the jobs in Alberta. It simply won't. And in fact, you can even look at the federal government's own submissions around climate change to get an understanding of this. You know, one of the arguments that the federal government makes is that that this won't actually make things worse in terms of climate change, because, as they put it, really the only thing that'll matter is the market price in terms of determining whether more oil is extracted and exported. So they're both saying that the pipeline's necessary to increase the amount of oil that's being extracted and exported, but then at the same time saying that the pipeline will be irrelevant to the amount that's extracted and exported when they're talking about climate change. So I think they need to pick one of these arguments. You know, the reality is that, you know, the public relations and what they're actually saying in their own submissions do not match. But I think this is just the nature of politics. I think this is a decision that has a lot more to do with, you know, telling people what they want to hear and what they think they need to say, as opposed to the reality. Part of this argument is often about, you know, the idea that there's actually going to be a higher price if you sell this stuff to China as opposed to the United States. There's been a number of pieces written recently by economists that show that that just simply is not the case anymore, that the price differential just isn't there. Again, this has been affected by the amount of fracking that's happening in the United States and the effects that's happening on the price sector. Some have even suggested that that selling directly to China may actually get us a lower price than selling into the United States. So, you know, again, the kind of the rhetoric isn't keeping up with the current reality. But, you know, even if all of that wasn't the case, I mean, you know, years ago when I started working on this project, you know, the price of oil was high. There was a price difference between selling to the United States and Asia. There is this larger conversation around, you know, what really is the national interest. And if we live in a world where we need to be getting ourselves off of, you know, consumption of fossil fuels, building new infrastructure that commits us to, you know, that approach for decades into the future is ultimately not going to be in Canada's economic interest. You know, perhaps, you know, there's some economic activity over a decade or 15 years. But the reality is that over a very short period of time, you know, the value of that oil would just simply be non-existent, like where we'd have to be moving aggressively away from oil.
Would you be in favor of refining the oil in Canada at the source to get a better price? Or what is the best way to drive this economy that's so energy hungry? Like, a lot of people I talk to say, oh, alternative energy just doesn't produce enough power. So how would you respond to that criticism?
Well, I mean, there's two things there. First one is that's just actually not true. I mean, renewable energy is actually cost competitive with natural gas in many jurisdictions already. Canada has a tremendous amount of renewable energy potential. The idea that it only works certain times of day leaves aside the idea that you're feeding energy onto a grid. You know, so even if you're not producing solar power at night, that doesn't mean that you couldn't produce more than enough power with solar to be keeping the grid happy. In fact, the majority of new energy projects that have come online in the world in the last few years have been renewable energy projects because of price, not because, you know, the world's being run by a bunch of hippies, but actually just because it's a lot cheaper to manufacture solar panels en masse than it is to go looking for more and more difficult to find oil and gas further offshore, further underground, you know, using fracking or steam-assisted gravity drainage. I mean, we're literally going as far away from conventional crude oil as you can to the least economic sources of fuel, largely because there's some very wealthy companies who've got a lot invested in kind of maintaining the status quo. And unfortunately, they're using, you know, stuff that's just factually inaccurate to continue to try to sell that. I would first, you know, push back on the very premise there that renewable energy can't produce enough energy. In fact, you could, you know, set up solar panels in a small corner of Nevada in the desert and produce enough power to, you know, power all of the United States. The limiting factor is not the cost, nor is it the viability of the technology. This is one of the things that drives me crazy about when Trudeau says that we need the pipelines to pay for the wind turbines. The reality is we just need a strategy and some leadership to actually make this a reality. And what we've seen in California, in Hawaii and Germany and in places where they've actually made, you know, it their intention to actually, you know, bring this stuff online is that, you know, that there's so much demand that the suppliers can't even keep up with it. In fact, in some jurisdictions like in California, You know, people can just lease their rooftop to a solar provider, and then the company makes back the money for the investment in the solar panels, and you get your energy price reduced and actually start getting a source of revenue after a relatively short period of time. That's the first part of your question.
Yeah.
Of course, as an environmentalist, I have concerns about refineries. You know, they're toxic, and you know it's not pleasant for anybody to live near one. You know, there's risks to human health. You know, and there can be accidents, explosions, that kind of thing. You know, that being said, well, we are dependent on fossil fuels right now, and I'm not suggesting that that's going to change immediately. Like, I think that's often one of the problems with these debates is that, you know, people say, well, you know, you're a hypocrite if you drove to work and you're opposing a pipeline. But, you know, just because that's our current reality doesn't mean that a lot can't change in a decade, 2 decades, 3 decades, let alone the, like, century or so that a piece of infrastructure like a pipeline will last for. You know, so the question is, which direction are we heading collectively, and what are we doing to, you know, to help us move in the right direction? I'm not a big fan of the idea of building new refineries, but, you know, I'm actually surprised we don't hear more of that from the NDP. You know, in terms of what creates the most jobs in the industry, refineries are really actually the best paying jobs in the oil sector. And, you know, having that work done responsibly is, of course, important. There is an argument that you could make that currently we're basically exporting a lot of the risk and a lot of the harm and the jobs at the same time by shipping so much oil down to Washington State and California so they can deal with the pollution. And, you know, we're also creating more risk by moving all that oil back and forth on tankers just to, you know, bring 2/3 of the oil that we actually consume here in British Columbia back and forth. So, I mean, there, you know, you definitely could make an argument that building refineries in Alberta or, you know, in BC, close to Alberta, would at least mean that we weren't dealing with conventional crude oil moving through the existing pipeline. One of the dangers is that often the idea of these refineries is used as a way to justify new pipeline infrastructure. You know, and I, for one, you know, as you could guess, I'm not a big fan of the expansion of our dependence on fossil fuels, especially more carbon intensive, more dangerous fossil fuels. You know, so I you know, I don't think it's really the right direction for us to be heading. And there's not a hell of a lot of appetite for this in Canada anyway, from industry.
Every time I have this kind of conversation with people about pipelines, it's about 5 minutes in when someone always says to me, we have to strike a fair balance between environmental protection and the economy. You know, we need to protect the economy and we need to protect the environment. We have to strike a fair balance. How would you respond to that argument?
Well, I mean, again, I think this is just kind of a misunderstanding of the current realities in the world. I mean, of course, it's a fight between the economy and the environment, I mean, basically everybody loses, right? Like, you know, one way I used to answer this question was, you know, to ask people to think about the root of each word. You know, the word economy and ecology actually come from the same Greek word oikos, which means household. Economy means the management of the household, and ecology means the study of the household. So, I mean, basically, if you're managing an economy without being aware of ecology, you're basically managing with something without studying or understanding it. That might be an oversimplification, but I think it's a useful starting point, at least for the conversation. You know, but to get more specific about it, I mean, the reality is, if you look at reports written by the BC Treasury Board, you can create 3 times as many jobs per dollar invested if you invest in climate solutions than you can if you invest in the stuff that creates the problems. You know, so if you're really serious about job creation, I mean, we should be investing in public transit. I mean, we should have better building codes. We should be looking at the kind of buildings that we're building and whether they're, you know, the kind of buildings that are ecologically sound. Just doing things in smarter ways actually creates more jobs. You know, of course, everybody needs to be able to feed their families. And frankly, I think this is just one of those frames that's been used to attack environmentalists, basically accuse them of not caring about people and their ability to feed themselves and their families. But the reality is that there's actually much better, smarter ways to create jobs than just kind of doubling down on industries that are clearly sunset. If we're really being smart, we'd be looking at incentivizing more of the solutions being based here in British Columbia and Canada. You know, Did you know that Canada as a country invests less in research and development than Toyota? You know, I mean, this is a place where we're really not valuing the intellectual capital of the average Canadian. We could be doing so much more to leverage the innovation and the smarts of people in this country instead of, you know, so aggressively just kind of doubling down on the worst possible industries really in today's day and age. And frankly, the hypocrisy of being seen as a climate leader while, you know, expanding the export of, you know, some of the dirtiest fossil fuels really is going to catch up with this government sooner or later.
Tell folks how they can get in touch with your organization. Also, what are some small things people can do if they want to push back and save this beautiful province from that kind of devastation that a pipeline spill or tanker spill would bring?
Sure. Well, a lot of the work I'm doing these days is actually in support of the Tsleil-Waututh First Nation and their Sacred Trust Initiative. Sacred Trust Initiative is the campaign organized by the Tsleil-Waututh Nation, who are the people of Burrard Inlet. You know, they've actually done more to really protect this this region than I would say the provincial or federal government has done. They did a more in-depth study of the potential impacts of a spill and really an assessment of the project than I think the NEB did. It's actually a longer study, and there's more research that's good research in there. A starting point for everybody is to really just educate yourself more on the issue. One of the things I've been working with Tsleil-Waututh Nation on is trying to provide basically answers to every question that you might have about this project. So if people are interested, check out twnsacredtrust.ca. There's a tab at the top of the page that says Kinder Morgan Concerns. And if you follow that tab, you'll see a lot of questions and answers. And, you know, the other thing is, you know, like reach out to me through social media. I'm easy to find on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, you name it. You know, I'm constantly kind of putting out updates and new bits of information. And I'm also quite eager to talk to people about, you know, what questions they have or what you'd like to see in terms of questions being answered. There's a lot of ways to get involved right now. There's a major fundraising push around First Nations legal fights, and there are a number of them, both from First Nations groups and non-Native groups who've taken the federal and provincial government to court. But in particular right now, I'm trying to help support the Tsleil-Waututh Nation's fundraising efforts around their legal fight with the federal government. There's a campaign called Pull Together. If you Google that, you can find a whole bunch of events that are being organized. It's a great way to meet other people who are already involved and to you know, build your awareness. And if you don't see your community represented there, I should say, I mean, there's you know, a lot of different folks who are getting involved in this fundraising effort. Like, for example, this weekend at the Russian Hall in East Vancouver, there's a group of artists who've organized a fundraising event at the Russian Hall on Saturday night. But, you know, if you're, let's say, a comedian who doesn't like pipelines or a ballet dancer, you know, there's an opportunity through the Pull Together website to actually set up your own fundraiser, invite people from your own community. And I really think that's the critical thing, right? Like, you know, hearing from people you know and trust already always means a heck of a lot more than, you know, some activist like me telling you, you know, what's important. So I really encourage people to, like, educate themselves, to talk to their friends and neighbors, their families. It's going to really take the power of people to stop this thing. We're never going to have as much money as this Houston-based oil company. But, you know, if you look at the history of projects that have been stopped, it's always been good old-fashioned community organizing. And, you know, that means, you know, you, if you're listening to that, you know, this is an opportunity for you to, you know, even if it's just talking to five people, you know, those five people, if they talk to five more people, you know, that's really what makes the difference. And if you feel like you don't have all the information that you need to really do this right, please reach out to me, and we'll try to make sure that you have whatever you need.
Thank you so much again, Ben. And Ben can be reached at Tankerfree BC if you just Google that. And I thank you so much for spending your valuable time with us. Have a great day.
You too. All the best.
We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Visit Latin Waves Media to hear previous shows, to access resources, or support our efforts towards social change via community project engagement. Thank you, and bye for now.